What's up, peers? And I welcome you to join the WasabiCast, a Bitcoin privacy podcast. I am Max Hillebrand, and today I sit down with the one and only amazing Andrew Chow, who has such a fantastic history in the Bitcoin rabbit hole. I mean, the guy is still in high school, found Bitcoin and the free software ethos, and just, you know, started contributing to wherever he saw interest and where he saw fun. And not just that, he even managed to make this his business. He's an entrepreneur demanding to be paid in Bitcoin and actually working on Bitcoin software projects full time now. Really an inspiration with his motivation and his work ethos and the grand vision of a better Bitcoin wallet infrastructure he is creating. It is really mind-boggling to the extent of how fundamentally he is improving how Bitcoin Core and all other Bitcoin wallets will work in the future. Again, not just talking about the vision, but actually implementing it. And today on this call, we really go by each of these building blocks one by one. So we talk about output script descriptors, or in other words, how to actually clearly and precisely describe who can spend this Bitcoin. Right? That's a very important task that a Bitcoin wallet needs to do. And that goes further to miniscript, which is a very elegant way to write a Bitcoin script so that it's actually humanly readable and understandable of what's going on. Again, who can spend this output? And building on top of that is the hardware wallet interface, which is a way that offline signing devices, like, for example, hardware wallets, can talk to each other and to other software wallets in order to coordinate that transaction signing process. Again, very important aspect. Basically, everyone is using a hardware wallet nowadays, and that will just continue, especially when we come to multi-signatures, which is affected by all of these previous things. Right? So, for example, backups become a lot more easy in a descriptor wallet if you're using multi-signatures. And I would say the final of these amazing conclusions or building blocks that come together is the Taproot protocol update, which will allow, as we've talked about now in many episodes, a much more beautiful signature algorithm for key aggregation, signature aggregation. We can hide a bunch of scripts and make everything much more compatible and beautiful. And all of this coming together really is the Bitcoin wallet of the future, a high quality, reliable and secure, incredibly flexible and easy to back up. Well, wealth manager, basically, a software that manages your private property contracts in the Bitcoin network. But that is not all that Andrew Chow is actually doing. He is, in fact, a very vivid live streamer and podcaster who actually codes even during the podcast. So for sure, check HL101 out on Twitch to see all his latest and greatest coding sessions, where he does that all with a great lot of humor and a lot of a charming character. So without any further ado, peers, if you like this type of content, share it with your peers and give it a like. And here it is, my conversation with Andrew Chow about the future of Bitcoin wallets. So Andrew, thank you very much for joining me today here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really interested because you are making a splash in Bitcoin development recently. Like, seriously, you're doing a monumental work on many fronts, and it's coming together as a really nice vision of a future wallet experience in Bitcoin Core that I'm really hyped about. So I'm very excited to talk to you about all this today.
Sure.
And maybe to start out with, like, how did you first of all get into the free software kind of ethos? What was your journey down that rabbit hole?
So Bitcoin was one of, I guess it was really my first major open source project that I contributed to. And really what happened was I learned about Bitcoin. I started using it. I started with actually a wallet called Bitcoin Armory, and there I found some bugs, some usability problems, and I decided that because that software only had one developer at that time, that I would try to fix these bugs myself, and see if I could, you know, fix problems that I saw and learn along the way, and that has eventually led me to working on Bitcoin Core, where I did approximately the same thing but with far more knowledge of Bitcoin and more confidence in my ability to write code. And yeah, it's just kind of snowballed from there.
Oh, cool. Very interesting. So Bitcoin really being that gateway into starting to contribute to all these free software projects. Why Bitcoin? What motivates you to work on that project?
I find the idea of a decentralized currency very compelling. And so for some context, when I started working on Bitcoin, I was still in high school. And at that time, being, you know, under 18, I didn't have a credit card, didn't have a bank account. If I wanted to purchase anything, I'd have to, you know, go ask my parents or find some cash somewhere and pay for it. And Bitcoin, I found Bitcoin to be really interesting at that time because it was a way that I could earn money and spend money without involving my parents at all and do it completely online without needing any third party. And so from there, the idea of having a decentralized currency just really stuck with me.
Oh, wow, that's fascinating.
I also find the technology to be very, very cool.
Yeah, to say the least. Right. But fascinating that you really got into this mindset of also earning Bitcoin. Right, so what was your kind of experience there as a young entrepreneur in the Bitcoin space?
I've always been interested in computer science and programming. So I started out with just on the Bitcoin Talk forum, just like, you know, seeing if someone had a request for that they would post something saying, hey, I'll hire someone to write a script for me or implement this, that, whatever. And if I thought I could do it, I would say, hey, I'll do it. And I'll do it for whatever you say you'll pay me for, because, you know, I have no idea how much that's worth. And that's just kind of something I did in my free time. I also dabbled in mining a little bit, but yeah, there's a lot of like freelance software development. I'm pretty sure what I wrote early on was not very good though, but you know, it did what they wanted and they paid me for it.
Oh, that's just awesome. Right. I mean, for one, you make your hobby, right, just coding and solving problems in the Bitcoin space. You just make that your job, right? You somehow figure out how to get paid for exactly just doing that. So that's already awesome, right? And then also, right, you see that the value that you provide, right, is really dependent on the individual that you provide the service for, right? You, as you said, like, you just, what is it worth to you that I write this script for you? And that's a really nice mindset to actually approach entrepreneurship and, you know, solving problems for others and seeing where they have the most dire need to get that problem fixed.
Yep.
Yeah. So you spoke that you contributed a bit to Armory. Can you maybe say what was that project all about and what were your contributions to it?
Yeah. So Armory is a software wallet. It uses, so their whole goal was to be like the most secure Bitcoin wallet ever. Well, okay, back in 2011, 2012, I would probably have believed that. But nowadays, not quite. But the project itself was written in Python. And it, as far as I can tell, it was one of the first wallets that it was a full node, but only insofar as it used Bitcoin Core in the background. So when you used Armory, you had to install Bitcoin Core and it would run Bitcoin Core in the background for you. And it would use that, you know, for, instead of having to implement, you know, block and transaction validation, it would just let Bitcoin Core do all of that. And it would take the data from Core over, RPC and reading from disk as well.
So the Bitcoin Core node had the private keys in its wallet file.
No, so Armory would handle the private keys itself. It handled the private keys, transaction selection, transaction tracking, all of that. And it would just use Bitcoin Core for the peer-to-peer node and validation parts. It didn't use the Core wallet at all.
Okay, that's interesting. So, I mean, here we maybe see already that discrepancy already back in those days, that Bitcoin Core's wallet part was never really, I'm not sure if it really was used much, but there was always the strive to have different wallet implementations. Why do you think that was the case?
I think a large part of that comes down to how slowly Bitcoin Core makes changes to everything, including the wallet. So when we will get new innovations in wallet stuff, wallet security, new things like BIP32, it would take ages for Bitcoin Core to implement them. And, you know, by the time, or, you know, when something new comes out, everyone wants to use it right away, or hopefully everyone wants to use it right away. But if Core isn't going to implement it for another 2 or 3 years, then you have to turn to someone else to get that. And so I think there started being a lot of other projects that had different value propositions, based around the fact that it was harder to get different features and ideas implemented into Core itself. So one of like Armory's main things was that it provided a very good UI for doing offline signing. It actually essentially made a precursor to PSBT. And they had their own, unsigned transaction format, and it was easy to have Armory as a watch-only wallet on one computer and have Armory as a cold, as a air gap wallet on another computer. And you could, you know, pass the data back and forth on a USB drive or something. And so Armory had this really good UI for doing air gap and cold storage type things. But Core didn't have that. And I mean, even today, it kind of still doesn't have that.
Why do you think that there is such a maybe slow adoption for some of these features in Bitcoin Core?
I think it comes down to developer resources. So, you know, Core is a big open source project and has many developers working on it, but each developer just kind of does what they want to do, what they think is cool, what they think is interesting. And sometimes there will just be parts of the code base that no one thinks is cool or interesting, and it just never gets worked on. And I think one of those was the wallet. There's perhaps also a bit of fear of causing people to lose money. There's certainly that in consensus related code as well. So the wallet, I think, just didn't really see much action, for a while. It was also really tightly coupled with the node part of things, and that made it difficult to make changes. But that's improved over the years.
Yes, that's one of the, difficult problems to solve in free software, right? That anyone can just work on whatever problem he thinks is the most interesting, right? But what about these overarching, like long-term problems that need to be taken care of, right? But are difficult and complex to figure out. So how would you go ahead and solve this problem of the early Bitcoin Core wallet? Like how would you improve that? And what is your vision for that now?
Well, so that's kind of what I'm doing now is to overhaul the entire wallet. I have a very long-term goal of essentially rewriting the whole thing. And really this entails just like figuring out all the individual pieces of the wallet and changing them over time. So one of the things that, the old wallet did was it was centered around keys. And a lot of wallets did this, a lot of wallets still do this, where everything's all about the private key, right? But really in Bitcoin, what we have are scripts. And in your script, you can have a key, but your script can also have tons of other things. And so that's why right now, I've been working, well, it's been merged for a long time. It's been released for several months now. It's the descriptor wallets, which changes that whole paradigm away from, you know, everything's around the key to everything's around a script, which we can add some syntactic sugar and turn it into a descriptor. And within the script are our keys. One of the other big issues in the original wallet, and this is just because it was the first software, I think, the first wallet software, is that, being able to support BIP32 was non-trivial. And that's also why BIP32 took like 3 or 4 years just to get merged into Core. Because all the different approaches that were made to doing that, just didn't fit well into the old wallet structure and, still remain backwards compatible and all that. So now with descriptor wallets, I basically gave up on the idea of being backwards compatible entirely, and really just trying to move to a new paradigm that is also really easy to add new things to in the future. So by having, by being based on descriptors, we can just add a new descriptor and get something new in the future.
Mm-hmm. You bring up a lot of interesting points. And I think the first one to pick out is that aspect of no longer being backwards compatible. And so why was it that the early Bitcoin or the early changes to the Bitcoin wallet always strive to be backwards compatible? And why do you think that now is a good time to break that and to start from scratch?
So the main thing in Bitcoin Core has been that if you took a, or at least in the wallet, is if you took a wallet from 2009, you could open it in 0.21 today, or probably. And that's because we try not to make changes that make the new software unable to open old wallets, because then you might prevent people from being able to access their coins. And having to maintain all of this old code to handle what we used to do in the wallet, a bunch of old things in the wallet, has just made also just changing the wallet itself much more difficult. So now, with descriptor wallets, so since descriptor wallets is such a large departure from the original, we call it the legacy wallet now, we just decided that, I decided and convinced everyone else of that it would just be better to say we're going to make, because descriptor wallets are incompatible logically, descriptors are not logically compatible with old wallets, that we might as well just put a clean breakpoint right here and break as much compatibility as we can at once, so that moving forward we can still maintain compatibility with future things. So part of the descriptor wallet change was changing the database. For the legacy wallet, we use Berkeley DB 4.8, which is also at this point unmaintained for about 10 years. And we're switching to SQLite for descriptor wallets. So with this move, what that means is in the future, in maybe 2-3 years, Bitcoin Core will not be able to open and use a legacy wallet, a wallet that uses Berkeley DB and the legacy wallet structure. So at some point in the future, you will not be able to take a wallet from 2009 and open it in Bitcoin Core. And this is kind of it's a big change, that we are trying to make it smoother for people. So, you know, between now and 2 or 3 years from now, you know, there'll be ways to migrate your wallet from legacy to descriptor. And even after we remove BDB, there'll still be a little bit of like compatibility that will be able to, a bit of compatibility code that will be able to read the BDB database file, pull the stuff it needs out of it, and make a descriptor wallet. So, it was just like, now I felt like, you know, we've been holding on to this old stuff for so long that it's becoming a problem. And so we should just kill it as soon as possible.
Yeah, it's a very tough decision, right? Because backwards compatibility is something we treasure in Bitcoin on many fronts, right? And breaking that is always tricky. But as you said, right, if there are easy ways to kind of take the old format and port it to the new format, which can then be processed by Bitcoin Core, that might not be an issue. So do you think that this kind of conversion code from the old format to the new will be in Core directly, or will you need some external software for that?
It'll be in Core directly. I have a PR open to do migration from legacy to Descriptor. And then eventually I will also start writing the code to handle a minimal implementation of reading a BDB file. And, you know, I actually have such an implementation in the Python test framework right now because for something I wanted tests for, I wanted to be able to read the database file. So it's even the database format isn't even that complicated. So implementing it won't be that difficult, and it won't be a whole lot of code either.
Yeah. And once that code is there, I don't really see an issue with breaking backwards compatibility if it is trivial to update to the new, you know, especially if there are so many positive outweighs for it. Yeah, absolutely. So let's go a bit more deeper into descriptors. You spoke about them a lot, and about the more trivial example, but what are some advanced use cases that you envision in a world where descriptor wallets are widespread?
So descriptor wallets leads us to, well, first with the output script descriptors, these describe a script pub key and everything you need to spend it. So right now in Coral, we have our descriptors for, you know, the standard pub key hash, witness pub key hash, multisig, and, you know, script hash, witness script hash, those things. But SIPA has been working on Miniscript for a long time, and Miniscript is really an extension of descriptors. Miniscript kind of came out of the idea of descriptors. So eventually these descriptors will be able to support Miniscript, and Miniscript is a language that allows us to describe a lot of just arbitrary scripts that can do lots of crazy things. So you can have like a bunch of like if else branches, do these, this and something or this or something, time locks and relative time locks and all of that stuff. So Miniscript really opens up the avenue for having scripts that can do basically anything that you want, within the limits of the scripting system, of course. Scripts that you can do almost anything that you want. And then having that inside of descriptors means that we can represent those to a wallet, to our descriptor wallet, in the same way that all other descriptors are represented to the wallet. And it can just understand what to do with that script. It'll know, when you want to sign a transaction, it'll know how to fill out the transaction with that script and all the things that script needs in order to produce a valid transaction. So with descriptors, eventually we'll get Miniscript. And then this just means that the Bitcoin Core wallet will be able to support signing, literally any script that you want. You can do any outrageous contract, however smart or stupid it is.
I mean, that sounds fantastic, but why wasn't that the case before? Because, I mean, you know, Bitcoin script was very exhaustive before. Why couldn't just the wallet do these arbitrary scripts in the legacy script type system?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And it's really because it's really hard to understand Bitcoin script. So as I think we all know, Bitcoin for a very long time was all about the keys, right? It's why it's called the script pub key, even though it's a script. The output script's called script pub key because it really, you know, back when Bitcoin came out, it was just a pub key. And it was, the input script is called the script sig because back when Bitcoin came out, all you had there was a signature. But Satoshi had this whole scripting system that no one really used. I mean, I think someone did a look through of the entire blockchain history, and for, you know, first several hundred thousand blocks, or first couple hundred thousand blocks, you just didn't see any weird scripts ever. And this is really because that the scripting system is hard to understand. It's hard to look at a script, know what the opcodes are, and then understand how to spend, how to create a spend for that script, because the scripting system is a fourth based scripting system, and it's just hard to reason about all of these opcodes and the different branches and all that. So what Miniscript provides us is a framework to understand these. Miniscript is a subset of the scripting system. So it's not even all the opcodes that Bitcoin allows. It's like, I think it only uses maybe 20 of them. And there's like 100 something. And what this allows is for a way to understand, to reason about what a script does, all the conditions for reaching every branch of that script so that you can know how to sign for it in the future. So a lot of previous scripts are just, you know, to reason about it requires being a human and thinking about it and staring at it. But with Miniscript, we can do it with a computer. And this makes it a lot easier for everyone, because now you could describe a contract in human terms and you can get a Bitcoin script that maybe if you look at it, you don't understand, but the compiler, the Miniscript compiler can tell you everything you need to know about it.
Yeah. So this is somewhat to get like a easier to understand representation of what the underlying Bitcoin script actually does, right? All the weird opcodes in the stack-based language, the Miniscript compiler gives you a somewhat humanly readable and understandable, output. So, this of course is more intuitive than to understand for everyone, but, it seemed to previously Bitcoin Script was just about the developers, right? And surely developers of wallets will benefit from having a Miniscript, but it might even be that the end user will benefit from this new, more intuitive way to write Bitcoin contracts. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. So the idea is hopefully eventually there'll be, just some kind of GUI tool you can download and you can make your own contract, and it'll spit out the Miniscript for you. It'll spit out a full descriptor and you just add it to your wallet. And you don't have to even understand the details in that descriptor. You can just know that the compiler has interpreted what you want to do and created a script for you. So hopefully in the future, we can have a lot more interesting scripts going on. And also Miniscript handles a lot of the edge cases too. So even if you're a developer and you're looking at script, there's a lot of really weird things in the Bitcoin scripting language that are completely unintuitive and non-obvious. And the only way you would know about them is if you actually read through the script interpreter code, and like really did it in detail, because Peter, Andrew, and Sankat they all worked on Miniscript and they've all come across some weird behavior that they only discovered because, with their Miniscript stuff, they're able to do fuzz testing and generate random Miniscripts and see what happens when you run them through the script interpreter. So there's some weird shit. And if you're not aware of that as a developer, you could end up writing a script that doesn't quite do what you expect it to do.
Yeah. I think anywhere in Bitcoin, if you look hard enough, there is some weird shit happening.
Yeah.
One other thing that I heard about Miniscript that maybe you can explore a bit more, is how it does optimizations, in how to, write and execute a script to use the least amount of block space.
Right. So this was a hard problem for Peter, Andrew, and Sankat to solve, I think. And so the idea is basically you can have many scripts that boil down to the same logical thing, right? If I have some contract, I can write it in many different ways in Bitcoin script. Some of them might be less efficient than others. There's some things with like multisigs where sometimes it's more efficient to use the opcheck multisig. Sometimes maybe you just want to add up, when you do a signature, it pushes a number to the stack and you just add them up. There are different cases for all of these. And what I think they've ended up doing is that, because also one thing that they do in Miniscript is avoid any sort of transaction or script malleability, that they can accurately predict and know how big the script will be and all the elements that go into it when you want to sign. And so they can, you can produce a script that's optimized for certain use cases and won't use as much block space just because there are different ways that, that you can write the same thing. So one of the really coolest thing, cool things that they've done is, in a script where there's like a common case and then like a fallback case, you can tell the script, the Miniscript compiler, that this common case is, say, 1,000 times more likely to happen than the fallback case. And so then the compiler can optimize to make the common case like really compact and really small and just kind of ignore how inefficient the fallback case might be, because, you know, the fallback case, that's just for emergencies and, you know, shouldn't ever happen. So it happens with low probability and it's okay if that is a bit bigger. But then the common case, you know, that's going to be the one that happens all the time. So we want that to be efficient. And so the compiler can, you know, adjust, how efficient the different branches are, in that case.
One other important aspect that I would like to bring up, is, you know, how do you back up this entire thing? Right? Because specifically with hierarchical deterministic wallets, BIP32, as you mentioned earlier, right? Here you have one root backup, your 12 or 24 recovery words, and out of that you get all your public keys and all your public key scripts and so on. So it's very easy to make a one-time backup for the entire duration of your wallet. Now, this wasn't always the case, right, in Bitcoin's early days. And do you think that we will go back to a future where updates will be a lot different than what they are now?
Yeah, so one of the things that Miniscript does is you can include an XPUB or an XPRIV inside the Miniscript itself. So the key, if you have a key expression, the key can be, you know, a pub key, private key, or BIP32 XPUB XPRIV. And in the end, what you get from Miniscript is just a string. So you just get, you know, a string with a bunch of parentheses and other stuff in it. But it's still just a string, and you can back up that string just like you would back up, say, an individual private key. But because this string also includes, you know, it can include your XPRIV and all the derivation paths, this backup actually can describe your entire wallet as well. So it probably won't be like BIP39 where you can memorize 24 words, but you can still get a string that you can write down on paper if you really wanted to, or, you know, copy to some text file that you encrypt, or, you know, stuff like that. And it would still be a backup of your wallet. Now, you may have to back up multiple strings for like change, or if you just have different scripts going on in your wallet. But that's a more complicated topic. It's still roughly the same thing where you just have strings to store somewhere.
Yeah, but that's actually interesting, right? Because with multisig wallets, right, just having your 24 words is not going to be enough. Because you need to know the public keys of the others. So there you will need to back up some additional wallet in any case, right? And it seems with output script descriptors and Miniscript, this just becomes like you can encode the entire information in one compact string and somehow then encode this in, you know, a QR code, potentially even some humanly understandable words or something. But yeah, this is very promising, no?
And another thing is that even with BIP39 right now, you have your 24 words. Try importing your 24 words into different wallets and you will get different addresses every time. And that's because everyone uses, well, ideally everyone uses the same derivation paths, but right now many wallets use different derivation paths for their addresses. You know, the common one is BIP44, 49, 84, but sometimes wallets will use a different derivation path, and this information isn't encoded in that seed phrase. So even with your BIP39 mnemonic, you still have to record the derivation paths that you use. No one does this, and it's actually kind of a problem. There's also the other thing of, you know, the seed phrase only tells you keys. It doesn't tell you what address type. It doesn't tell you if it's, you know, PDPKH, legacy address, or if it's SegWit address. And, you know, hopefully in 6 months, it won't, when we have Taproot, it doesn't tell you if it's Taproot. So you still have to store that information somewhere as well. But of course, no one does that. And that's also a problem. Descriptors pretty much solves it, because in your descriptor, you put your derivation path, and the descriptor tells you the script pub key, which therefore tells you the address type. So descriptors like bundles up all the things that you need to back up into one string or a couple strings that you just put somewhere.
Yeah, that really sounds like a massive improvement. And also, again, right, not just for developers, but also user-facing, right? This will change the entire backup of the wallet procedure, improving it, right? Especially for advanced script users.
Yep.
So you teased it just a second ago, right? Taproot, of course, massive topic and one that you're involved too. How does Taproot tie into these output script descriptors and Miniscript?
Yeah, so Taproot, for the Bitcoin Core wallet, because we decided the legacy wallet is going to die soon, Taproot will only be supported in the descriptor wallet. And the way that we're doing that is just by adding a new descriptor. So, SIPA has already opened APR, implementing basic Taproot descriptor support. And this, so he's added a descriptor, TR, for Taproot, and it just takes a key will take some script stuff in the future. And that's just how we're going to add Taproot to the Bitcoin Core wallet, is just be another descriptor. In terms of Miniscript, I believe all of the TapScript things, can be represented in Miniscript, or rather the other way around. Miniscript can represent all the TapScript stuff. Maybe there will be some extensions for specific Taproot things in Miniscript. But what that will eventually look like is you have a Taproot descriptor with Miniscript inside of it, and the compiler will just know, okay, because, you know, at the top level, we are Taproot, then inside we need to construct a script in this way rather than in the legacy case. So it all just kind of builds on top of each other, right? There's no like specific compatibility that needs to be done. It's just adding new things on top of descriptors and Miniscript.
One of the concerns that I see, especially when looking at it from a privacy side, is that if you give the end user the ability to write really crazy custom scripts, right, and to make that really easy, that can lead to quite an on-chain fingerprint, right, of what scripts were used for change address detection and such. How do you think that will play out, and how can we maybe protect users on that regard?
Yeah, so that's a good point. And really with SegWit and legacy addresses, you can't avoid it. But with Taproot, you can. So if everyone uses Taproot, Taproot allows all the script stuff to be hidden away. So if your Taproot contract is mostly going to follow the common case where you basically just have a key, then any crazy script things that you might do later doesn't ever get shown. And they only get shown when you use that script path spending. And even in that case, it's only the particular script path that you are spending with that gets shown. So all of your crazy scripts and stuff can stay hidden until you have some fallback scenario where you really need them.
Yeah, and I think that ties in nicely with that earlier set weighting of how likely one case is to go, right? Yeah. Because if you really know the most common case, you just put that as the Taproot, at like the top level Taproot public key condition, right? And that's that.
Yeah. So Taproot has an implicit common case, really, and it's, you know, it kind of assumes, you know, there's multiple parties. If there's one party, then it's a little pointless. But so the assumption is that if everyone agrees, everyone involved agrees, then you just have a key, and it just looks like a key spend because everyone agreed. It's only when you have some kind of disagreement that you have to break out the scripts that do weird things. So in that common case, you never even know that there was a script hidden inside at all. With a single user thing, if you have like, say a time lock, I guess that doesn't really work because then you always have to reveal the script, for that time lock to work. But that then kind of degrades into the P2SH, P2WSH level of privacy.
Yeah. And I think one of the cool user facing implementations here would be that, you know, as the top level, you just have your single private public key, right? As regular, but then you can have like an emergency backup situation, where if after 1 year, the coin has not yet been spent, this other public key can spend it, right? And this is just in case you lose your wallet and your recovery words, your output script descriptors in that sense.
Yeah.
that you can then still recover it in some other wallet, right? So
yeah,
this is, I think, like just one very simple example, but the possible, you know, things that we can build with that are endless.
Mm-hmm. One thing that has also been brought up is, quantum resistance. So if we want to soft fork in a quantum safe crypto in the future, you can add a script path in a taproot spend committing to that quantum public key. But then, because it all just ends up in that taproot output, you're not wasting space on the blockchain for your quantum backup plan. Only when you need that quantum backup plan do you then consume, I guess what is now 4 kilobytes of space for a quantum key on the blockchain or something like that. So when we have, you can like, with Taproot, we can hide so many things, even really big things, inside of the Taproot script path, that no one will ever know about until we need it.
So to sum that up, in Taproot, right, we have this top level condition, which is just a public key. And then inside that public key, we commit to a Merkle root, right? So to another commitment to a bunch of different pieces of information. But how many Merkle leaves are there actually? So how many different script conditions can we commit to in one Taproot output?
2 to the 128. Your Merkle tree can be 128 levels deep. And because a binary tree, grows exponentially like that, it's 2 to the 128. So you can have literally any condition you want with basically any number of conditions that you want. I think you will run out of computing power to generate that before you run out of conditions.
Yeah, hopefully it's going to be enough.
Yeah. But I hope 2 to the 128 conditions is enough. But if you need more than that,
let us know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that really is fascinating, right? And each of these conditions can be really, really long. Right, crazy complex, even with different, you know, cryptography, as you said, with quantum resistant crypto, right? But as long as you will not use it, right, as long as you use some other condition in the path, or in the tree, or of course the top level condition, you don't have to put that information on chain, which has two crazy good benefits. First, of course, you consume less block space, means you have to pay less fees, right? You can have all these advanced conditions, and they're gratis if you don't use them. Right, that's an awesome insurance hedge, basically. But the other side, of course, privacy. Right, so all of these custom scripts that you're tinkering on, where you're maybe the only one that's actually using that in the entire Bitcoin network, as long as you actually don't end up using it, nobody will know. Right, and that's a very powerful addition as well.
Yep.
So, like, help me through this. How does Miniscript optimize how to write the scripts for each of these Taproot branches? Because I mean, there are so many of them. How many small pieces that is this actually being hacked up?
I actually have no idea. So you have to talk to Peter, Andrew, or Sankit about that. Cause I don't work on Miniscript that much, but I know they've been working on, I think, the current priority in Miniscript is to get the Taproot descriptor first, and then they'll work on how Miniscript handles all of the Taproot things. I believe that's not implemented yet.
Okay. Well, I'm very curious on how that will actually pan out. Do you think that we have missed any important information about, you know, OpenScript descriptors and Miniscript and Taproot?
I don't think so.
Then let's move to one of the other very important parts that you're tinkering on, and that is, of course, the hardware wallet interface, which is another essential building block in your future wallet vision. So tell us about it.
So the hardware wallet interface, which we call HWI, because I'm bad at naming, it's a command line tool and a Python library for interacting with hardware wallets. And the goal is to have a unified way to communicate with every hardware wallet out there. This is not entirely true, because it doesn't communicate with every hardware wallet out there. We have some rules about what hardware wallets we will support. But the end goal is for Bitcoin Core to support hardware wallets. And to do that, it would, in discussions about how Bitcoin Core would support hardware wallets, the conclusion was that Bitcoin Core would have to call some external tool in order to do the communication with the device itself. Because we don't want to have the device-specific code and device-specific drivers inside of Core itself, especially USB drivers, which are quite a large thing. So HWI is that external tool. The original goal is to have Bitcoin Core call HWI. HWI would return, would communicate with the device and return data to Core in response. In one of my projects, which was to get hardware wallet support, I started writing HWI. And actually, the goal of hardware wallets in Bitcoin Core had three components. We had this external tool, and then we also need some way to communicate all of the information needed to sign a transaction to that external tool. And the last part was, of course, the integration with Core's UI and all that stuff. So HWI is the external tool, but PSBT, BIP174, is the way that we communicate all of the information from Core to HWI for signing a transaction. So that's what I've been working on for quite a while now.
And now, where's the difference between PSBT and output script descriptors? Why can't you just give the hardware wallet the output script descriptor?
Right. So, in addition to the descriptor, you actually need to know You need to know information from the blockchain and the UTXO set. When you sign a transaction, you need to know the output that is being spent by an input. And you can't get this information from a descriptor because that contains things like the TXID, the amount, your amount's not in the descriptor. The script pub key is in a descriptor. So that's something that is there. And so PSBT contains all of that information. So you have fields for the previous transaction output and actually for non-SegWit, or rather for legacy spends, you have to include the previous, actually this is true for SegWit as well. You have to include the entire previous transaction in order to verify that an input is really spending, for the hardware wallet, it can check that for an input, it's spending the right output with the correct amounts. So PSBT encapsulates all of that data, for the hardware wallet in one place. And it has other uses as well.
Yeah, so maybe to sum that up is that the output script descriptor clearly defines how to spend the coin and where to find the keys that you need to spend it inside your wallet, right? That's what derivation path and such. While the partially signed Bitcoin transaction includes more information than that. It's not just the information of how to spend one input, right? It's about all the inputs and outputs of the transaction and the values to them. And later in a stage, even the signatures to them, right? They are also included in a PSBT format.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, PSBT contains all of the other blockchain data that you need as well. That's the main point of PSBT.
Can I construct PSBT signatures by inputting the output script descriptor?
Maybe. Depends on your software. So in core, we only support signing PSBTs through the wallet. So the wallet needs to have the keys on the descriptor, and that's only when you can sign. But maybe there will be other tooling that allows you to give a descriptor and for it to sign. So one of the nice things about PSBT, though, is you don't necessarily need to have the descriptor. This is partially for compatibility with the legacy wallet. So PSBT has fields for the redeem script, for mostly the redeem script and witness script, and also pub keys and their derivation paths. So this is useful for hardware wallets, which don't have descriptors. And I actually wouldn't expect a hardware wallet to have a descriptor, but be more of a dumb key store and signer. So for those things, that don't have a descriptor, they need all that extra information. And if you just have private keys with a PSBT, you can still sign it given everything else that is contained within.
How are PSBTs useful for example, multi-signatures among different hardware wallet devices?
Yeah, so PSBT contains a field for signatures. In previous multi-sig workflows, you would kind of hack the signatures into the unsigned transaction itself. But PSBT dedicates a place for signatures to go. So if you have a multi-sig, you would, when you sign it, the PSBT that comes out would now have a field that says, here's for this input with this pub key and this pub key in this input, here is the signature for it. And then at the end, when you are finalizing the PSBT and making the transaction to send to the network, you can go and say, I need a signature for this pub key and look that up in the PSBT and get the signature and put it in the right spot. So, since you can have multiple signatures for different keys in an input, PSBT allows you to have multiple signature fields. So for a multi-sig, you would end up with many pub key to signature fields.
Uh-huh. So the hardware wallet doesn't necessarily have to finalize the PSBT itself, right? The hardware wallet just provides the stupid signature over the SIGHASH and then gives it back to the coordinator.
Yeah, so this is I think this is one of the really beautiful things about PSBT. And this works with arbitrary scripts basically. So because the signing algorithm doesn't require you to understand the script, it just needs the script as data for the signature. You can have a hardware wallet that only knows how to make a signature and it can sign for any arbitrary script without understanding what that script is doing, because it doesn't need to in order to make a signature. Now, of course, with Miniscript, and for usability reasons, you probably do want the hardware wallet to understand what it's signing. So with Miniscript, we now allow a hardware wallet to look at the script and figure out what it's doing to tell the user before they sign.
Uh-huh, yeah, that's a nice addition of Miniscript, right? All of a sudden, we have a very condensed Miniscript that the hardware wallet can read and then display in human-readable form, maybe with some other encoding, right? Mm-hmm. To make it a human-readable sentence of what exactly is going on. Yeah, that's really fascinating.
Yeah.
There is currently a talk about a new BIP proposal to coordinate these hardware wallet multi-signature rounds. Do you know a bit about that? Can you speak a bit to it?
I've been asked to look at it, and I haven't. So I actually I have no idea.
Do more, better, review faster. No.
Yeah. Busy with other stuff. It's on my to-do list, along with everything else on my to-do list. So I can't say anything about it because I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, it's ever growing. So like, what are your thoughts on all this? Like, bringing all of this together, right? Output script descriptors, Miniscript, Taproot, PSBT, HWI, all of that, that's like starting to be a pretty high quality wallet experience in Bitcoin Core.
Yeah, it's honestly, it's also been a lot more than I thought it would be. When I first started working on Core, I didn't expect to be making so many things and so many large changes. Yeah, hopefully, you know, at the end, I hope that the Bitcoin Core wallet will be a much better user experience, where you can use hardware wallets, where you can use arbitrary scripts, and where it will also be a lot easier for us to update in the future with new cool things that come out.
Why is the update mechanism superior here?
Because it's not, it doesn't require us to change the wallet format. It doesn't require us. So, I always go back to BIP32 for this because I think it's the most clear change, or most clear example of it, where in order to implement BIP32, to do it the right way would have required several new records, and a complete overhaul of how keys were being generated, a complete overhaul of how keys were being stored, actually, for like, you know, the proper implementation of BIP32. We never did the proper implementation. We kind of did a half-assed thing where essentially what we did was replace the key, the random number generator with a BIP32 deriver, and then added a few extra records in the wallet for it. So I think that with descriptor wallets, really, the main thing is with descriptor wallets, and I guess with Miniscript, making changes in the future mostly amounts to changing or adding a new descriptor. And this doesn't require us to change how things are stored inside the wallet. It only changes what is being stored. And so that means that an upgrade, doesn't require us to write a ton of wallet code. It just requires some descriptor code.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, right? And on top of that, Taproot also provides more upgradability just by upgrading the tap version of the tap leaf, right? Mm-hmm. So this ties into all of this nicely as well.
Yeah.
So maybe let's move then on to the big other elephant in the room that you're involved in. I mean, we've spoken about the numerous benefits of Taproot multiple times on this podcast already. And in this conversation totally confirms it. I mean, Taproot is just mind-blogglingly awesome. So how the hell are we going to implement it? How are we going to activate it?
Yeah, that's a very good question. How are we going to implement it? Or how are we going to activate it? So the consensus is around BIP 8 something, basically. BIP 8 is the successor to BIP 9. I guess we're counting backwards now. So BIP 9 was what we used for SegWit. But also, a lot of people don't remember this. It was successfully used in a previous activation for check sequence verify. And that one went off without a hitch, which is why I think no one remembers it. So BIP 9 was a way to activate softworks and actually also activate softworks in parallel. But it used a parameter we call median time passed, which is the median timestamp of the last 11 blocks. But because it's based on time, there's a lot of little funky things that can happen. A lot of weird edge cases around the start and the timeout time, that are avoidable if we change to using a block height. So BIP 8 is, one of the biggest changes in BIP 8 is that instead of using MTP, it uses the block height for everything. So now you can say, you know, that instead of saying the soft fork will begin, you start signaling for the soft fork on this date at this time, which, could be slightly different because if, you know, with stale blocks and all that, the median time pass could actually not be, it can change for a particular block height. But with block height, you know, on block X, regardless of stale blocks, block height X is always that. So BIP-8 is more clean in that way. BIP-8 also introduces some other parameters. The most contentious one is called locking on timeout. And basically, what this means is that when the software times out, instead of failing and not activating, nodes will activate it. And it does this by forcing miners to signal in the last signaling period. So there's also a new state where at the very last signaling period, if locking on timeout is true, then miners must signal for the soft fork up to the threshold. So this would allow if there was a simultaneous locking on timeout false, to also activate at the same time. And this parameter has been what has been most contentious about whether we should use locking on timeout true from the start or whether we should do it locking on timeout false and then see what happens and then later decide if we want to do locking on timeout true. There are a lot of arguments for and against it. I have been, I would say, consistent in my position that we should start with doing locking on timeout false. What we do afterwards is dependent on what the outcome of the start was. And so that actually leads us into the latest idea, which we're calling speedy trial. And the idea here is we can do a really short locking on timeout false deployment. So this would use a start time of soon and a timeout time of 3 months after the start. So this would, you know, if it succeeds, it'll succeed quickly. If it fails, it'll fail quickly. This is in contrast to the normal deployment time of 1 year between start and timeout. So with speedy trial, we would have this shortened signaling time. But then we, you know, because 3 months is not that long, and if the start time is or start height is really soon, not everyone might upgrade. We add a new parameter called the minimum activation height, and it's as the name suggests, the minimum height that activation can occur. So with speedy trial, what we're planning is to have the start height be fairly soon. Timeout height be about 3 months after that, and then the minimum activation height is 6 months after the start. So if in speedy trial the first signaling period reaches the threshold, then we got to wait all 6 months before it activates. If either way we have to wait the 6 months for it to activate if it activates. But by the timeout height we will know whether it has failed or not. So that's the current proposal that is gaining some traction, although there is also some more debating around other things related to speedy trial.
Yeah, I think speedy trial is a very interesting proposal because it kind of mends both hearts of the two sides. Because I think on one hand, we see those who say, well, in a lot equals force, these miner signaled soft forks are really smooth, right? If miners actually signal and very safe. And they work out, right? We saw that with CTV. But on the other hand, we saw how it can go wrong, right? Specifically if incentives are not aligned. And we saw that especially during the UASF of SegWit, right? Because here, all of a sudden, miners had a financial incentive not to signal readiness, so to delay the activation and to further use ASIC boost, which was a patented, very profitable mining addition. Only accessible to some. So in that scenario, the miner signaling clearly failed as a coordination mechanism. However, it kind of, in the end, right, did still work just based on the threat of a user-activated soft fork, a lot bit true, a lot equals true. So this, and I think with speedy trial, we give the miners the opportunity to coordinate a smooth and miner-activated soft fork, which is hopefully the safest way to go. But if there are complications arising again, Now, hopefully we will at least hear about them soon and then have faster data point of whether or not to do a UASF movement again.
Yeah. And yeah, so this proposal has kind of united the two camps a little bit. So, you know, we have the lot false people who get a lot false deployment, and we can use that to gather data and see what happens. For the UASF folks, this speedy trial will happen very quickly. And the original timeline was for it to, if it would fail, it would fail before the UASF would even start. So, so for them, it's a reasonable compromise because, by the time they want to have everything started for their UASF, then, they'll know whether miners have activated or not, because their time frame is already several months out. And speedy trial almost fit within the time between now and then.
Yeah. So I'm really curious. I mean, we see that already based on some estimations and surveys that there is a rather large percentage of miners who are ready to signal readiness in the future. So just based on these early estimates, you know, maybe it can really be reached a 90% signaling threshold in just 3 months. Hopefully, right? That would make things a lot smoother. Mm-hmm. But so let's assume this best case. Like, what are the next steps for you on the Bitcoin Core wallet? Like, how soon do you think that Taproot will actually be usable out there?
So, right now with Taproot, we actually have it active on the Signet. So this is, Carly Wolf's, signed block testnet thing, where Taproot was always active. And so with testing out the Taproot wallet stuff that, SIPA has written, we can do it on Signet, and I believe people have been, so in the best case scenario with speedy trial, we would get activation in November, which is, 8 months from now. And in that time, hopefully we can have at least the basic Taproot signing support in implemented into core. You know, doing the key signing stuff, single key things, that's not very complicated. It's really with the whole TapScript and Miniscript side of things where we get a lot more complicated things that probably won't be ready in for core for quite a while now. Especially since Miniscript isn't available in core yet. So it wouldn't really be a huge departure from what we do now with SegWit and legacy, support.
Yeah. And again, based on the anonymity set analysis, right? We would just love to see as many users as possible on Taproot as soon as possible. At least as soon as reasonable, right? Because we saw how with SegWit, it just took quite a long time, even before native SegWit got adopted. And of course, that means a lower anonymity set for those users, specifically the early adopters. Right? So how do you think that will play out in the short term, with the actual usage?
I expect that Taproot usage will take quite a while. It will probably be similar to SegWit. I do think it won't be quite as slow, I think, because SegWit required peer-to-peer changes and changes to the transaction format. And so those changes they're a lot more, you know. Implementing that takes more time, takes more testing. It also introduced a completely new address format in Bash32, which I think only recently BitMEX finally started supporting Bash32, you know, 4 years later. So I don't think Taproot will take quite as long, because a lot of the things necessary for it already exist. You know, we're not changing the transaction format. We're kind of changing the address format, but like just a little bit. It's just changing a constant. So hopefully we'll get Taproot, usage sooner than SegWit, but I mean, I don't expect that when Taproot activates that, you know, we'll have day one, even 10% usage on day one, you know, but hopefully more people will be using Taproot, sooner than the amount that started using SegWit.
Yeah, I hope so too. And I hope that for, you know, single sig wallets, it's a small enough change. Although, I mean, it's still a change in the signature algorithm, right? So that's not to be, it's not too small.
It's not trivial, but
exactly.
But, I mean, Schnorr signatures actually aren't that complicated either.
Yeah, that's true. Right. But I mean, here, right, this is, I hope that wallets like, for example, Wasabi could start doing that already quickly. But there are not really major benefits for single sig wallets. I mean, the real true benefits really come from advanced script wallets like multi-signatures or Lightning Networks or vault constructions, right? So, I think that hopefully in these areas, we will see Taproot adopted a bit sooner, as them pioneering as early adopters.
Mm-hmm. So, on the single sig side, Taproot has a few benefits in that it's a bit more compact. It's not huge. It's like a signature is like 65 bytes instead of 72. But you also lose the, because Taproot outputs are the pub key and not pub key hash, there's more space used in the outputs. But yeah, Taproot's main benefit is from the script side things and especially multisig. So I'm hoping that, you know, a lot of multisigs that we see now, which take up a lot of space on the blockchain, you know, I'm hoping that those will move to Taproot quickly, and can, be much more compact and give us a real boost in the amount of transactions that can fit in a block.
Yeah. Have you actually dabbled a bit in the Lightning Network and the improvements that we can make with output script descriptors and Taproot in that regard?
I run a Lightning node and that's about it. I haven't really used Lightning that much. I don't really have a good reason to spend money other than from my salary to pay for food. So I don't really use the Lightning Network and I don't even spend any Bitcoin anyways. But I do run a Lightning node and I do kind of follow what's going on in the Lightning space. And I since Lightning uses multisigs, Taproot would be quite useful there.
Yeah, and what do you think about Miniscript in Lightning? Is that something meaningful?
I haven't really thought about it. I think because Lightning is based around a fixed set of scripts already, like, you know, HTLC script is a specific script. It's not actually all that useful. The only use may have been to use Miniscript to generate the scripts needed instead of requiring people to think about it for so long. I don't really think there's a use for Miniscript inside of Lightning itself. Although, I seem to remember that Miniscript may have produced a more efficient HTLC script than what we ended up with.
Interesting.
Maybe it was a different script. I know it was either like HTLC or maybe it was something in Liquid where Miniscript actually made a more efficient script, than whatever the engineers came up with, which I think is really cool and like really speaks to the power of Miniscript.
The AI is taking over the world. It's like a supercomputer winning at Go all of a sudden.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a compiler. It's like GCC. I'm pretty sure GCC will make far more optimized code than I can write with assembly by hand.
Yeah, sure. One of the other things I'm curious about is, you know, in this world, especially with output script descriptors, how do wallets all of a sudden interoperate? What do you think?
Yeah, with descriptors, we do get quite a bit of wallet interoperability because if everyone supports descriptors and supports the same descriptors, you can take a descriptor and just put in a new wallet and get all of your same addresses, and the keys. So with descriptors, then it might actually be a lot easier to change wallets, if, you know, maybe the wallet you're using doesn't allow you to do manual coin selection or doesn't have a good coin selection algorithm. You could import your descriptor into something that does and not have to, worry about sweeping the funds or even making a new backup, right? You just copy and paste the descriptor. I think it may even lead to more and better innovation in the wallet space if people can just jump wallets freely.
Yeah, right. I very much think so too. And also, I think it will save on transaction fees, right? If instead of having to send from your phone mobile wallet to your desktop wallet, for example, right, where you don't have to do that with an on-chain transaction, but you just scan a QR code to get this output script descriptor with the private key imported into the new wallet, right? Much better for privacy. And of course, you save on fees.
Yeah.
And one other thing that was a bit of a struggle while working on a software wallet that wants to use Bitcoin Core for verification of the consensus. How do you think that in the future, like external wallets can verify with the Bitcoin Core wallet that this is a valid coin?
So the main thing is through the RPC interface. And right now, the RPC interface has a lot of commands that you can use to verify some things. Actually, now that I think about it, I'm not sure if there's a verify a transaction output, but there's definitely you can verify a transaction output proof, which is the Merkle path to the transaction itself. There could be more improvements there, and it changes to the RPC are fairly simple. And mostly boil down to someone wanting it and someone feeling like they should do it. So if you want more features in the RPC interface, feel free to open a feature request and maybe it will happen. Although sometimes you might have to do it yourself. But sometimes, when I have nothing better to do, this hasn't happened in a while, I will go through, find a feature request and implement it myself.
Nice. That's a very gratuitous task.
I might start doing that for my stream, actually, when I run out of things to do.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the other big rabbit holes that I want to talk about. I mean, you know, I love doing podcasts and love listening to them. But no, you do the same, but while coding. I mean, that sounds amazing. Tell me about
it. Yeah. So I started doing this Twitch streaming thing where I write code on a live stream. And it's been pretty interesting to do. It's hard to come up with ideas to do for that. There are some things that I feel like probably aren't compelling enough to show people. And so I don't do it there. And there's some things that, you know, since I work for Blockstream, there are some things I can't show on a stream because they're things for Blockstream and not open source. I mean, it's technically open source, but not things I want to show. Sometimes I do have a hard time coming up with what to do on my stream, and maybe I will just find a feature request and implement it. Lately, I've been doing a lot of Taproot stuff, as probably expected.
Yeah, what is the kind of interaction that you get out of these calls or live streams?
So Twitch has a chat feature, and so people who are watching you can say things in the chat. They can talk to me or talk to other people. There hasn't been a whole lot of interaction. Most of it's been around, you know, questions about Bitcoin itself. Some people do ask about, like, what am I doing? And if I could explain more in depth about what I'm working on. A lot of it is, a lot of it to me feels like, what do you call it? Rubber duck debugging, where you explain, what you're doing out loud to an inanimate object like a rubber duck. But for me, it's the Twitch chat. I'm explaining what I'm doing, and by doing so, I can end up catching some bugs or some logical flaws just by, you know, vocalizing, you know, what I'm doing. And I found that to be pretty helpful.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I see the same with, for example, podcasting. And I mean, it's one thing to sit down and to listen to a podcast, right, and to accumulate that information. but you tend to forget to think, right? To actually, sit down and seriously think if what you hear is right or wrong. And a nice trick to get you to think is to force you to speak, right? Because you cannot speak without thinking. That's just impossible. So as soon as you speak something out, you will automatically do some thinking. And if what you're saying is stupid, probably you're going to get shivers and you will realize it, right? Yeah. So that's awesome that this works in coding too.
Yeah. I also found that the streaming has actually motivated me to do things that I wouldn't normally do. So in the past, I didn't do a whole lot of code review. And it was mostly out of, part of it is that I never really felt comfortable with code review. I never really felt comfortable with like that my feedback was useful. And you know, the only way to get better is to do it, which I hadn't really been doing. But when I started running out of things to implement on my stream, I decided maybe I should try streaming code review and see how that goes. And I found that, by doing that, it made me better at reviewing code, made me feel more confident in the reviews I write, you know, when I do code review off stream. And so now I've decided to start doing code review more often on my stream. And, I think a lot of people find that interesting as well, because it's not just me writing whatever I feel like, but I'm also looking at what other people have written, critiquing it, explaining ideas that other people have had, and finding things that I wouldn't have necessarily done or thought of.
Yeah, that's cool, right? Kind of this drive to, you know, speak about something new, something that, you know, is novel, kind of leading you to actually try out more things, right? And do things that might have been boring in a different set and setting, but just because you can talk to it all to your webcam. Also, you know, the other aspect is it's not just you talking, it's you getting instant feedback too. So did it, for example, happen that someone in the audience found a bug that you were writing and notified you in chat?
Yes. Usually happens with typos because I'm really bad at spelling. And I just spell something wrong that I wouldn't catch until I try to compile it later. That's happened a few times. There's also been a few times where someone has pointed out a logic error that I didn't realize at the moment.
Right, that's fascinating. It's kind of this instant feedback, this instant review, and you know, especially if it's high quality and sincere, that seems to be like a very efficient way, actually. Or do you think that the review comes too early, right? That it's kind of just wasting your time, but you would have found the bug anyway as soon as you would have looked over it again.
I think not really. So some of these, most of these comments are on, you know, small things that I definitely would have caught them later. But sometimes it would be something that I would have taken me hours to find just because it is like something that seems inconsequential at the moment. Right. So if someone points out, you know, oh, you you wrote less than instead of greater than over there. That might have taken me a while to figure out. But since it's pointed out right away, then that's actually pretty useful. Although there are some comments that do like completely sidetrack my stream, just like a question about something that just derails the whole thing. I try to avoid derailing, but I'm also completely okay with going on a side tangent for a few minutes.
Yeah, that's cool. No, I like that free flow of conversation and thought, right? That's always very interesting to listen to as well. Who do you think is your audience for that live stream? Like, is it just people who are actually Bitcoin developers or just, you know, random people looking into what you're doing?
I think I'm trying to gear it towards people who are technical, but not really involved in Bitcoin development. So people who are interested in knowing what's going on, kind of understand how everything works and want to maybe like also want to get into development as well. I wouldn't say it's quite targeted for current developers. Although I do have occasionally current developers joining in and leaving comments. Sometimes people I know will join in and just the, what's the right word for this? Make fun of me for how I write code. I've gotten comments from a few people on my poor usage of Vim, but, but yeah.
Oh, the toxic Vim maximalists.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it's crazy what when you see how these wizards actually use Vim, right? And no clue how what's going on, but they do all the things in a couple keystrokes. It's
best. Yeah, I do not consider myself a very good user of Vim. I only started using it, I guess, more than a year ago. But you know, there's still a lot of keybinds and shortcuts that I should use, and I just don't.
Yeah. Yeah. So Andrew, is there any other big topic that you want to bring up here?
So, you know, every time I'm on a podcast, I always end up talking about coin selection. Maybe I don't want to do that this time.
That's
I guess
a fascinating topic.
Yeah.
It is. You know, maybe to put a spin on it, something that you have not yet maybe talked about, because that's one part that we're currently doing in the Wabi Sabi CoinJoin algorithm. Is the coin selection as well, specifically coin selection in a coin join. So what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I don't think it makes, I guess you have to target a specific change output for a certain, do you need to target change output size? I don't remember. But if on the surface, it seems like, you know, your normal coin selection for a single sig thing would probably work because you're acting independent of the other participants. Although then it does make fee estimation far more complicated. Yeah, coin selection has so many variables to it that it's hard to say.
Actually, you know, to be honest, I think we've kind of given up. I'm not sure, but I think we've given up on fee estimation. Of the coin join, because I mean it's just too crazy. Well, I think it's just a flat thing that we put in there for every user.
So the thing that it seems like actually this was probably a major breakthrough in coin selection is to do this. So in Core we call it effective value, where the inputs pay for themselves by you take the value of the input and you subtract however much you would need in fees to pay for it. And then the result is the effective value because that's effectively how much it contributes to the output. And this is kind of I would say it's a major breakthrough actually because it makes fee estimate, well, not fee estimation, but like calculating the fee for the transaction a lot easier. Cause you don't have, what we do in Core now, cause we don't have effective value implemented yet, is where we do a loop where we select coins, see how much we need in fees for that. And if the amount we didn't select doesn't meet that fee requirement, then we go back and try again. And, sometimes it works and sometimes it comes up with a weird result. But I think effective value gets rid of the loop entirely. We do it in one shot and it makes reasoning about how to determine fees for a transaction a lot easier.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a bit similar actually to what we do with Wabi Sabi, that each input has a certain size, like of times the fee rate, and the value for like that mining fee is even subtracted from the fee or from the credential in the CoinJoin metric itself. But one of the things that I actually want to bring up is because if you have multiple users providing inputs and outputs in this collaborative CoinJoin transaction, you can actually adjust your own coin selection and output selection, right, and the amount of each output, based on what amount other users have provided. Somewhat similar to a Knapsack decomposition. Hmm. Did you consider this as well?
Not really. but in a coin join, so you may want to have your change be more similarly sized to what other participants are doing? Is that what it is?
Yes, exactly. And of course, the goal would be to not have a change at all, right? That you can somehow figure out how to decompose your input amount. So which means, first of all, finding out which input coins to select, so that you can decompose this amount in only standard amount outputs, right, that other users are using as well. Right? So not that you're the only person that uses a standard amount, but that you have a crowd in an anonymity set.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, well, so in Core, we do have an exact match algorithm that works pretty well. So given, you know, the inputs in the wallet, we can find, given, oh, well, it depends on the size of the wallet, how many inputs are in the wallet, but we may be able to find a set of inputs such that it's close enough to the amount that you want that we can just, that it's okay to burn the rest as fees. So we have that in Core, and that may be something that you want. We call it the, again, not great naming, but branch and bound algorithm. This is something that Mark Earhart came up with for his master's thesis.
Yeah, that was a really cool algorithm too. And by the way, just now in the re-implementation of the graphical user interface for Wasabi 2.0, the team actually has implemented a rounding control so that we show your screen that if you increase or decrease the sending amount by 0.1%, for example, then you save on fees and improve your privacy by not generating a change coin. And so this is now a conscious choice of the user if he can bear to send a bit more or send a bit less, right, for the sake of fees and privacy.
Yeah. Yeah, not making change in your coin selection is very helpful.
Yeah, very much. It's a very curious thing. I should probably get Yuval and Adam and the other researchers listen to all of this and come up with some smarter questions for you on how to improve the coin selection if you're so fascinated about it, because I know that it's a big open question that we had in the optimization for all of it.
Coin selection has been one of the major areas I've been working on. So before this, I started working on it before I started working on the hardware wallet stuff, actually. And I have two PRs open to Core for implementing some coin selection improvements, like effective value. And then I have like another two PRs not open yet that are for a lot of follow-ups just to clean up all of our coin selection stuff. Coin selection is like one of my major projects in Core.
That's really fascinating. There may be a couple more interesting follow-up questions here. Like, what do you think about the idea of adding, for example, metadata of who knows about this coin, basically who was the sender of the coin to you, like who sent you the coin, and use that in the coin selection. So for example, right, if you, Andrew, sent me one Bitcoin, right, and later I want to send you half a Bitcoin back, then it, especially for privacy, makes sense to use that coin that you sent me, that I send it back to you, because you already know that this is mine now. So, you will not learn any new information. Contrary, if I send you the coin that I got from Adam Fiskor, right? Because then now you will know that I got this coin from this other history. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's probably a good idea, especially in a privacy-focused wallet. In coin selection, you know, there's a couple steps before you get to selecting the coins themselves, and one of them is a pre-processing step where you want to find all the coins that you want to, that you would be okay with spending. So in Core, we have an option called avoid reuse. And basically, if you're avoiding reuse, it's, as it says, avoiding spending an input where the address for that input has already been spent somewhere else. So in our pre-processing step, we check if you have this avoid reuse setting enabled, and then we check all of our inputs and see if we've marked any of those, if we have any metadata that says that that input has been used, well, the address for that input has been used before. And if it has, and you've got the setting enabled, we don't consider that UTXO for spending. In like Wasabi and other wallets, you can have metadata like that filter out the outputs, the UTXOs that you are comfortable with spending before you move on to actually choosing what to use for the transaction.
Yeah, and this is actually done because Adam really got pissed off with how Core worked with that, because he had a Bitcoin wallet that he meticulously labeled and clearly separated all of his coins and always did manual coin selection. Right? And then one time he selected all of the coins in the GUI and typed in just a smaller amount to send. And he thought that Bitcoin Core would just use this as a pre-selection, but still do automatic coin selection on top. But in fact, it actually put all of these coins in the input of the transaction, therefore clustering his entire wallet right, with common input ownership heuristic. Right, so
yeah, the coin control feature is a little weird.
Yeah, yeah. But so based on that, Wasabi actually has from day one, because he got so pissed off that he started to write his own wallet, basically, he put in that feature that even if you select all the coins, Wasabi will just see that as this pre-processing stage, as you call it, for the automatic coin selection that comes afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense for something to do, and we should probably do that.
I think Adam would be very happy.
Yes. And this is also one of those things where, like, I don't think anyone who works on Core realized that this was an issue, partially because no one uses the GUI wallet. So you know, opening an issue and saying it, and someone who is interested in the wallet and coin selection, like me, may have saw that and said, "Ah, we should change that."
Yeah, yeah. How do you handle address reuse with the coin selection? So, what if there is multiple coins locked up with the same address, and now somehow the like, how do you handle that case?
So, we currently have two options that are related, but not that are related. So, we have avoid reuse, and we have avoid partial spend. So, if you have avoid reuse is that if we have spent a UTXO before, we don't spend any UTXOs with the same address. So that's what avoid reuse does. But avoid partial spend then says, if we have UTXOs of that use the same address, we want to spend all of them together at once, even if it doesn't quite make sense to do that. Like, say, you know, you have one UTXO would cover the amount that you're trying to spend. But in this case, with avoid partial spending, we group them all together so that we don't cluster them with other inputs in the future. So, yeah, we treat them essentially as one UTXO that happens to have a fairly large fee. But it doesn't really matter to our coin selection algorithm about that.
Okay, cool. Yeah, Wasabi does that second thing as well, right? To consider all these address reuse coins as one coin and always consolidate them so to avoid future clustering. That does make sense. How does Taproot come into coin selection? Like, any connections there?
No, not really. It's just another... it's just a UTXO and it just has different output size and different input size, and that's about it. So Core doesn't try to do anything with the scripts, for coin selection. So if this can lead to some weird behavior. So if you, for example, had a multi-sig in your wallet, and also single sig things in your wallet, it could choose to spend a multi-sig input and then a single sig input in the same transaction, which you may not want. And that's just because the coin selection algorithm, in our pre-processing, we don't consider the type of script for each UTXO.
Yeah, that's right. The UTXO is the treasure box. Right, and the script is just a lock. And for coin selection, you want to find out which box to open, and you don't really care about how to open the box at that stage. Yeah. Yeah. Is there anything we've missed in this deep dive down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin where you're at?
No, I think that's everything.
Covered it all. No, but yeah. Hey, Andrew, this was a phenomenal conversation. It really helped a lot to kind of see your vision of the future of the Bitcoin wallet ecosystem entirely, And I really think you've done a phenomenal job of thinking this through and finding the individual building blocks that need to be built, actually building them. That's amazing. And you've seriously done some wonderful contributions to the space. So thanks a lot for that.
Oh, thank you. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah. And well, I hope that we can continue, collaborating and using, the awesome software that you do, in Wasabi. I mean, you've been using HWI and PSBT since a long time, and hopefully we'll do the move to output script descriptors soon as well. And maybe even Miniscript, down the line once Taproot is there.
I'm looking forward to seeing more wallets use descriptors and Miniscript.
Yeah.
It'd be great.
Yeah, it's lovely to see that there is kind of this new generation of wallets coming out. The BWT or Sparrow wallet or, you know, others that use descriptors natively, right? That's really, really exciting. But I'm also curious when the legacy wallets like Wasabi is nowadays, which is kind of ridiculous as it's still very young, but, it's getting old. So I'm curious when we will manage to do the update, hopefully soon.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to seeing it.
Okay, Andrew. So where can the people find you? Where can they learn more about the work that you do and also support you?
Yeah. So my handle everywhere online is HL101. You can find me on Twitter, GitHub, Twitch. And actually, if you see that anywhere, it's probably me, including in video games. If that's where you want to find me, you can do that. As for support, I mean, the only thing is on my Twitch channel and I have a donations page, but I don't ask for support from people because, I have a job that pays me to work on all of this.
Yeah, that's amazing, right? To actually get paid for falling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. Kind of ridiculous, right? That some people will actually sacrifice their precious Satoshis just so that you can have more fun in the rabbit hole. That doesn't seem right.
Yeah, so I would say in terms of support, I don't need your support, at least not yet. If you'd like to support a Bitcoin developer, check out bitcoindevlist.org, I think. And I would highly recommend supporting Luke Dastjer.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he is one of the other amazing contributors to the space, who for sure deserves a lot of respect and for support.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, Andrew, it was a pleasure. Really, it was a phenomenal conversation. So thanks again for coming on. And guys, see you on the next one.
Thanks for having me.